March 24, a national day of mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through the agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Syrians used to say, no one sleeps hungry, but that was 13 years before the devastating terrorist war that was waged upon them, the war that has pushed many Syrians below the poverty line. SAID is an association that has been helping these people by providing daily meals to the needy during the fasting month for over a decade. Despite the increasing challenges, they are determined to continue with their mission.
We're currently operating a kitchen called Hunger Be Gone. Unfortunately, our resources this year are less than previous years due to the circumstances the country has been through, such as the earthquake disaster that drained a lot of financial resources. We distribute around 200 to 250 meals every day to the people who come to the association, while our motorcycle team also delivers meals to remote areas.
As a chef, I start every day at 9 a.m. by preparing the water and cooking the chicken for the scheduled meal. I have been volunteering for 5 years to help my fellow countrymen in these difficult circumstances.
Syrians have demonstrated their sense of responsibility in various ways during this crisis, particularly during the month of Ramadan. The holy month of mercy encourages people to be selfless and to help alleviate the sufferings of others. Voluntary work is one of the ways through which Syrians showcase their contributions to society.
So we are here not only to donate financially, but to donate our time more specifically. Volunteering is something very important, especially for our generation. We need to teach people that giving doesn't always mean that you need to take something in return. So we're here to volunteer with our time, to try to help people as much as we can. So SAID Association is our vessel to do that.
Today we came to make meals for the people in need. First we cut the vegetables, then we shredded the chicken, and now we are cooling down the rice and the chicken. Then we're gonna put it in boxes and give it to people in need.
Despite the United States' theft of their resources and the inhuman sanctions imposed upon them, which have put Syrians in dire living conditions, they steadfastly hold on to their love for their country, united against all the odds. They strive to find their way through this dark tunnel towards the dawn of a brighter life.
Syrians have always firmly stood together, not only against terrorism, but also in the face of unjust Western sanctions, through voluntary initiatives that show their love to each other and to their homeland. Ibrahim Wahid, Damascus.
Since the Al-Aqsa flood operation and the Israeli genocidal aggression against Gaza began early October last year, Hezbollah has taken a stance of defense against Israeli military targets near Lebanon's southern border. Now, months later, a propaganda campaign has been launched against such efforts, with social media posts and bulletin boards across the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and beyond reading slogans such as "Implementing international resolutions enhances stability" or "Lebanon does not want war." If you asked all Lebanese whether they would want an Israeli war to begin in Lebanon, the unanimous response would be no, especially with decades of experience with the Israeli regime and its disproportionate targeting of civilians. Yet what seems like a simple billboard has deeper implications for a country like Lebanon. Experts tell Press TV that certain groups in Lebanon have launched this campaign to put people against the resistance at a time of war. But are these factions working alone?
This campaign, we can say that it doesn't represent the Lebanese people. And especially in that it is, and we have informations, it is funded by foreign countries.
Those parties and those factions, they were controlled by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. The U.S. Ambassador, Dorshi Shea, as she was departing Beirut and also receiving her successor, Lisa Johnson, they were working on this in a way that would, help Amos Hochstein and his pressures put on Lebanon.
Hochstein, who is an Israeli-American businessman and lobbyist, has gone back and forth from Beirut to Tel Aviv in attempts to stop the resistance operations, without any mention of an end to Israeli violations of Lebanon's rights, which have persisted for over 17 years.
By supporting the resistance in Gaza or in Palestine, the resistance in Lebanon have prevented war. It didn't start the war. And especially when the Lebanese people and the Palestinian people and the Iraqi people and all people in the world are not protected by the international decisions.
Some people inside Lebanon, they are working as agents of the Americans and the Zionists, unfortunately, trying to accuse Hezbollah and the resistance of false things, misinformation, though it is crystal clear that the resistance is trying to protect Lebanon.
With growing popular support and despite the pressure from foreign and domestic sides, Hezbollah has been adamant on proceeding with its supportive military operations as long as the Israeli onslaught against Gaza continues. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The celebration of Nowruz and the arrival of the Persian year of 1403 was held at the Rome residence of the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Italy, a well-laid aft-seen table bearing seven auspicious items starting with the letter S was put out as the guests, mostly Iranian expats and Italians, were welcoming the first day of the new year and the arrival of spring.
Nowruz is much more than a tradition, it is a culture. Nowruz symbolizes the victory of good over evil, the balance of the spring. Nowruz means to lay all grievances aside and to celebrate family ties and friendship. Nowruz is a time for peace and reconciliation. It is a time for cleaning our homes.
The embassy's Nowruz celebration ceremony included a feast of Iranian food, followed by vibrant traditional music. Millions of people across the world celebrate Nowruz and its traditional rituals that emphasize the values of peace, solidarity, and goodwill towards all. 25,000 Iranians currently residing in Italy are among those who celebrate the Persian New Year.
Io vivo qui a Roma da ormai.
I'm from Tehran. I've been living in Italy for 40 years. Even though we are far away from our homeland, we were all waiting for the Nowruz celebrations. It's really important for us because that's where our roots lie.
Io sono Gaudia, sono italiana.
My name is Gaudia and I'm Italian. I've been married to an Iranian man for 49 years. The Nowruz tradition has become a part of my life. I love celebrating nature and renewal in nature, and I'm proud that I'm passing on this wonderful tradition to my grandchildren.
People at the gathering share the same belief that it is important to embrace Nowruz's universal message of renewal and unity, and that its celebration is also an opportunity to reflect on the past year, nurture new hopes, and celebrate the continuous cycle of life. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of people have engaged in a 41-kilometer pilgrimage, symbolically depicting the length of the Gaza Strip and a trek that scores of Palestinians have been forced to make due to the US-backed Israeli campaign of genocide against them. The event has been organized by a collective of Christian bodies. The organizers say it is important to demonstrate that Christian Zionism does not represent them.
The church has been very complicit within this genocide and within Palestinian suppression more generally, and because of that is not condemning what they're doing, is not recognizing what they're doing as ethnic cleansing and genocide, and not speaking out. And we wanted to challenge that narrative and challenge that stance and show an expression of solidarity, show that that's not the only thing coming out of the church.
The demonstration also coincides with South Africa's commemoration of the Sharpeville massacre, when the apartheid regime gunned down 69 protesters in what is recognized as a turning point in the struggle for liberation. For those who participated, the Palestinian suffering resonates deeply.
And what I saw today in my own, as I walked, you know, because it's a pilgrimage, reflecting, I say to myself, I feel my feet, you know, burning. I feel this old legs not moving as it should. But it's nothing in comparison what people are experiencing.
The South African public is still asleep, and they must start waking up to see what Israel is doing. For what they do there, they can also come and do anywhere else in the world.
I'm a proud Jew. I'm not a Zionist, and I never have been. And I think that what the Netanyahu government is doing is actually a moral genocide. Whether they call it illegal, I don't know whether it fits legally, but it's morally a genocide. And I'm appalled. I'm heartbroken. As somebody who's lived through apartheid, we have seen this before. We should know better.
The Gaza ceasefire pilgrimage coincided with the somber Christian period of Lent, and sacrifice and resilience were recurring themes pilgrims pointed to as they attempted to symbolically walk in the footsteps of Gazans. The Gaza ceasefire march is another example of the human resolve for justice, and as Palestinians endure the latest Israeli aggression for almost 6 months now, the people of the world will only intensify their commitment for Palestinian liberation. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
Afghanistan's reliance on Pakistan for access to international markets has been a long-standing challenge. However, recent disputes have pushed the Taliban authorities to seek alternatives. The Taliban have said they will invest around $35 million in Iran's Chabahar port, located in the country's southeast. The move aims to reduce Afghanistan's economic dependence on Pakistan, which has been marred by political friction and trade disruptions.
Chabahar is one of the most important economic and trade routes for Afghanistan. The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan tries to have a strong bilateral economic and trade relations with Iran as part of its economic policy. This port allows Afghanistan to broaden its trade with Iran, West Asia, and Europe. That's why we are specially focused on Chabahar and seek to invest there.
Analysts believe this could be a turning point for Afghanistan's international trade relations. They say that Iran has been an ideal trade partner for Afghanistan, and accessing Chabahar port will further facilitate Afghanistan's regional cooperation.
The benefits of Chabahar port for Afghanistan include its short distance with the country's borders. It allows goods to enter our country at a low price. It is especially suitable with the overall economic situation of Afghans. Another benefit is that it opens a big route for our exports, which is in dire need of expansion. When we become able to expand our exports, our economy will grow rapidly.
As the Taliban government seeks to diversify its trade routes and reduce its reliance on Pakistan, the decision to invest in Iran's Chabahar port marks a significant shift in Afghanistan's economic strategy. Experts say the outcome of this move will not only impact Afghanistan's relations with Pakistan, but also shape the geopolitical dynamics in the region. Iran and Afghanistan have the potential and opportunity to cooperate in many fields. Trade and industry in particular can bring the two neighbors closer in a very volatile region. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. and leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome. Now, the only effective and efficient way to deliver heavy goods to meet Gaza's humanitarian needs is by road, and that includes an exponential increase in commercial deliveries. Now, these are not my words, but the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who made the comments during his visit to Egypt on Sunday. He also warned of the impact of Israel's month-long war on Gaza that was having around the world. And this is exactly what we will be talking about in the next half an hour. I am your host, Gisum Shah Ahmadi, and you're watching The Spotlight. And to delve into the issues I just mentioned, we have with us Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, who is joining us from Tehran, and also Ramiro Funes. There he is, Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator who is joining us from Los Angeles.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight. Now, the daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis that is undermining the credibility of the international community in general. The entire world seems to be silent. Mr. Salam from Tehran, what do you have to comment on this one?
The latest massacres are absolutely barbaric. It's incredible to just see what's coming out. It's not just, for example, in the ones that we've seen in the past where they kill a bunch of people flat out. This time they're resorting to very sadistic acts of torture and revenge, specifically in the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital. We've all seen the reports about how they've been raping women, raping pregnant women, beating pregnant women, and then killing some of their victims, and forcing the men to watch it. That's while being, it's one thing when they kill people, which is obviously brutal, but to leave people alive and then to subject them to this kind of physical and psychological torture is absolutely unimaginable. It breaks the human heart into a million pieces. And the fact that they were able to get away with a lie saying that Hamas was the one who did this despite no proof. And in fact, many of the Israeli outlets backing away from their original claims, because not because they care about telling the truth, but because they realized their lies were too absurd to stand the light of day. But this is their sadistic and very satanic sense of revenge. And these types of massacres, as well as the terrorist attack in Moscow, occurred around the time of the holiday of Purim, which is actually a quite racist and genocidal holiday, which basically celebrates the genocide of Persians in the Book of Esther in the Old Testament, where the king of Persia was married to a Jewish queen, and she suspected that one of the people were trying to kill all the Jews, essentially, but turned out that's not the case. But she still ordered basically a mass murder spree of innocent people suspected of being, you know, the enemy of the people of Esther. So every year this holiday is celebrated, and it's not just extending to Persians, but anybody who they view as their enemy. This is like celebration of revenge. It's very, you know, very, very sick stuff. And it's the invasion of Iraq in 2003 happened around this time. So these types of vengeful acts, these bloody acts, happen to happen around this type of this time of the year. So this is a very sick and twisted army, and their terroristic acts should be condemned by the whole world. And the fact that the international organizations are just sitting there shows how useless they are. No matter what kind of statements they make, a statement is not going to make a difference. The only thing that is really hopeful for the Palestinians to end this absolute nightmare, as I've described, is the armed resistance and their allies in the world.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the whole world recognizes that it is past time to be silent, and there needs to be some effective measure taking place. So let's bring in our guest from Los Angeles to explain and elaborate more on that. As our guest from Tehran just mentioned, we need more than just rhetoric at this point in time. We need some action on the ground. So what do you expect from these international organizations, basically the international community, to do?
Like Brother Ali said, the international organizations are completely useless. The United Nations and a lot of the Western-led multinational institutions are not doing anything to rectify the situation, because they're never going to fundamentally get to the core problem, which is the existence of the settler colonial state of Israel in general. A lot of the dialogue has been presented as two-state solution, or how do we calm down the Israelis? How do we get them to pacify a little bit, to relent from Gaza, to relent from the West Bank expansions? But the problem is Israel in and of itself, the very nature of its existence, the very foundation of its creation, going back to Theodor Herzl and the World Zionist Organization. Just as Ali pointed out very brilliantly as well, the Zionists are very much portrayed as, in Western media at least, they're portrayed as secular, democratic. They're not these crazy religious fanatics as, unfortunately, Muslims are portrayed in Western media. But if we look at the people who are running Israel, they are very much religious fanatics. And a lot of these attacks coincide with Purim, with the Book of Esther, with Ishtar, which is the actual meaning of Esther, Ishtar, which is one of the Canaanite gods that they worship, a fertility goddess, if we go into the avenue. But a lot of this stuff goes deep into their mysticism and their religious extremism. They view Palestinians as animals. They don't see them as human beings. They don't see them as equals who they can coexist with. They see them as obstacles to their complete expansion. At the end of the day, we know that the two blue stripes on the Israeli flags represent the Nile and the Euphrates. They want to expand as much as they can. And for them, they see the Palestinians, the Arab peoples, the Muslim people in general, as the biggest obstacle. Because at the end of the day, the biggest resistance to Israeli Zionism is Islam and the axis of resistance, because the axis of resistance is firm in its faith and it rejects the lifestyles and appurtenances of Zionism, of commercial banking, of usury, of loaning money on interest, and all of these horrible things. And it is the Muslims and the axis of resistance that are giving the best fight to Israel because they are guided by an ideology that promotes humility and subservience to God and fear of God alone. And I think what we're seeing, I'm actually very optimistic about the prospects of change against Israel. It's not going to come from the UN. It's not going to come from the US or Europe. It's going to come from the Ummah. It's going to come from the Axis of Resistance in actually defeating Israel, not just fighting for a two-state solution, not just ending this current struggle that's going on, but completely and totally freeing Palestine and leaving Israel in the dustbin of history where it belongs.
But that is going to take, just as you mentioned, a very long time. So considering the situation on the ground, what do you think would be the best solution for at least a short-term humanitarian ceasefire to get aid inside the Gaza Strip? Let's see what Mr. Ali Salam from Tehran believes we should be doing.
Well, as our brother Ramiro pointed out, that they want to expand to the Nile and Euphrates, but you see they're so fragile even within the borders that they have. They can't capture the West Bank, so I'm optimistic as well. And they have been militarily humiliated in the past, two times in Lebanon. And even now, we can consider this a big humiliation, because never before has Hamas or the Islamic Resistance in Palestine been able to do these kinds of feats. If they expected anything around the time of last year, they didn't expect something of this magnitude. They wouldn't have expected anything that would have humiliated them, because the battles in the past have just been exchanges of rocket fire and rocket fire on the side of the Palestinians and airstrikes on the side of the Zionist occupation. Perhaps they thought it was going to be something like that. Again, few days cleans up. Now, this is something that has caught them by surprise, nor did they expect Lebanon to get in. I mean, the north is practically empty. There's no people in northern occupied Palestine. And if you look at the statistics of how many so-called Israelis have left Palestine and gone back to where they came from originally, like Europe or America or wherever, and people who say that they won't come back, more and more people are packing the airports and getting out of there. So this will actually eventually break the regime. The global shipping blockade imposed by Yemen, which is making the entire world pay the price for these horrible atrocities. There's at least some sense of justice here, and the optimism that our guest in Los Angeles spoke about. This optimism is that they're paying a price for what they're doing. They're not just standing there killing all these people, raping all these women, and getting away with it. That's the thing that we should be proud about. This is the achievement of armed resistance. If it wasn't for this resistance, they would do what they want to do, and they would get away with it. That would be the biggest crime, is that they would get away with it. But now they're paying the price. Eventually, it will break them, and eventually they'll have to declare military defeat, probably their biggest military defeat since 2006 with Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Salam, that is absolutely right, and I believe our guest from Los Angeles also agrees, and I agree as well, that the Israelis are now in a situation where they really have no way to go, and eventually they will be defeated, both on international scale, as far as international community is concerned. And now their true colors have been known to the entire world. So they have been practically defeated on all different fronts. But what I'm more concerned about in our discussion right now is the situation on the ground in Gaza, the situation that our Muslim brothers and sisters have as they desperately need aid to get in. And the trucks are there, the aid is there, but the Israelis won't let the aid in. And I would like to quote Antonio Guterres, who just said that they desperately need what's been promised, but they need a flood of aid, not trickles and not drops. So, Mr. Funes, in your opinion, what can be done to get that humanitarian aid inside? And that would definitely require at least a temporary ceasefire.
I think crucial to this is understanding the geopolitics of Gaza. Gaza has a large coastal front, and access to that coast is very crucial. So if we were to bring aid to Gaza, first and foremost, pressuring Israel to allow other countries, other forces, no matter what political tendency or ideology, to just bring in aid from the coast, because logistically that is the best option. Another option is obviously the elephant in the room, Egypt, which shares a large border and the Rafah crossing with Gaza. But unfortunately, Egypt in many ways has been difficult and has not been cooperating with the movements toward opening the border and allowing Palestinians in and bringing in aid. And it's very much, unfortunately, compromised by the Zionists. So I think logistically in real time now on the ground, the best situation would be some sort of massive aid delivery through the Mediterranean onto the Gaza coast, because that is its biggest coastline. Perhaps the U.S. mentioned building a pier. Obviously, we don't trust the U.S. in any of their plan, but I don't think the pier in and of itself is a bad idea. I would just like to see other nations or countries be able to be part of that, perhaps China or Russia or Iran, to be able to airlift products and goods and aid through the Mediterranean. But I think definitely Egypt would be a tremendous help, being able to bring aid through the Rafah crossing. But again, unfortunately, Egypt is very much compromised. So I think those are our two best options now. And I think anything that Iran would try to do would be perceived as a threat to Israel. And we know at the end of the day that Israel wants war against Iran. And so it's very much Iranian people want to do more and are doing a lot as it is now. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where we also have to tread lightly and delicately in the region, because any sight of an Iranian, you know, Red Crescent ship or aid from Iran is going to be perceived as they're supporting terrorism and this and that. So I think those are realistically the two probably best options right now. But again, very difficult.
So, Mr. Salam, in your opinion, why do you think attempts for a humanitarian ceasefire, and I'm emphasizing on this ceasefire to be humanitarian in order to get humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite the Geneva Conventions and everything that the Western world is so proud of calling itself the civilized world, why is it so difficult for them to get humanitarian aid inside, and why is this ceasefire so impossible?
This has really exposed their hypocrisy. As you stated, they're very proud of these types of things, their Declaration of Human Rights, Geneva Convention. We see how it falls apart. We see what it truly means when the rubber really meets the road. So, like our guest said, the Egyptians have the capacity. I mean, don't they control their own country? Aren't they a sovereign government? Apparently not. They were one of the first governments to normalize with the Israelis. And they have huge ties to the U.S. In fact, their current leader was installed by the U.S. So we can really, you know, to open up to create a scenario for at least a humanitarian ceasefire, as much as the Israelis will violate those terms, but they're going to be forced to the table. The Israelis will be forced to the table of doing this for the sake of their military defeat. That's what will pressure them. Just as the first ceasefire happened, because they were really getting hit very hard, and they were essentially humiliated. So they have to get hit more and more hard. But I think they don't want to get embarrassed a second time around. They don't want to get like the full embarrassed. Like when the full war ends, they'll be totally embarrassed because they can't guarantee the safety of their illegitimate settlers. But on the diplomatic side, at least when it comes to the untrustworthy Qataris and the untrustworthy Egyptians, we can hope for the equation of the declining and weakening U.S. and the increasing strength of Iran and, to a lesser extent, Russia and China, because Iran is the most bold in support of Palestine compared to the latter two, who do not exert to the full capacity that they could exert, but still better than what the position of the West is. And in fact, we see this in the agreement that Ansar Allah of Yemen has had with Russia and China, and that basically Russia and China will have no problem with Ansar Allah. And Ansar Allah, because the Russian and Chinese ships are not participating in this genocide, they let the free flow of Russian and Chinese in any ship that's not participating in this genocide. They act like Ansar Allah is a threat to all global trade. No, they're very specific in who that they are targeting. Anybody else who's engaging in ethical business, free to go. So the pressure of this, I think this increasing political relations will allow Iran the diplomatic strength to basically push Qatar and Egypt and these other countries in a certain direction. Now, these countries will always be corrupt. They were born out of Sykes-Picot. They were born out of British colonialism and Zionism. But in their lust for power and their lust to want to stay in power and to be relevant in the region, they're going to have to move a little bit and play a little bit of ball with Iran in order to survive politically in the future. So the hope is in the increasing diplomatic strength of Iran, coinciding with the increasing weakness of the United States.
And we don't have much time left, so Mr. Funes, let's focus more on the situation in Gaza right now. The north of Gaza is practically cut off, so even if there is humanitarian aid in Gaza, it will not reach the northern parts of Gaza. Famine is looming there for the people who are still there, stuck in that region. And also, the situation in Al-Shifa Hospital is really terrible. It's something that is completely appalling. So but what do you think will take the international community to do something to isolate Israel to the point where it will have, out of at least fear of isolation on the international scale, to back off?
I think what will work the best in terms of isolating Israel and bringing international attention and solidarity with northern Gaza will be breaking the spell and the idea that Israel is somehow a victim. This is one of the main ways that Zionism functions. It portrays Israel and the Zionist settlers as victims who are defending themselves, who are just trying to survive, who are trying to build a democracy and a stable economy in the region. And these crazy people just woke up one day and attacked them for no reason. And they perpetrate the spell in mainstream media. They perpetrate the spell in academia. We see all over in the Western academic institutions people getting fired for being in any way remotely pro-Palestine. And the dominance of Zionism over the major institutions of influence, of media, of real estate, of banking, of all of these key institutions, the commanding heights of the economy, this is crucial to their power. So as long as they control that, they're going to distract people, they're going to misinform people, and they're going to, most importantly, make people afraid to call out Zionism, because if you in any way call it out, then you're somehow anti-Semitic. So crucial to that, just as Brother Ali mentioned earlier, is destabilizing the Israeli economy once they are no longer able to maintain their grip over those key institutions and commanding heights. Once we see the emergence of Iran, Russia, China, and the BRICS global economy as the alternative that is not dependent on Zionist usury, then we can begin to see the destabilization of the Israeli economy, and then these institutions will have more freedom to criticize, to actually bring and promote aid for Gaza and to change the reality on the ground. But I think right now, one of the main issues is that the Zionist media is making it seem that if you're bringing aid to Gaza, you're promoting terrorism, and thus they're going to accuse anybody of doing that as supporting terrorism abroad. So once we are able to weaken the Israel lobby from within, weaken their economy, and actually create an alternative, then it's going to be a lot helpful. I know it sounds very long-term and idealistic, but that's just unfortunately one of the realities that we have to face with today. But first and foremost, I think the actions of Ansar Allah, of the Axis of Resistance, in cutting world trade and blocking that trade and calling for immediate tension, I think that's the best that we can do. Direct action leads to direct change. And unfortunately, that's what's going to have to take for Israel to understand. They only understand strength, and you have to respond to strength with strength.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Funes. Whatever happens at this point in time in history, we do know that right now the armed resistance of the resistance front actually is now very justified by the entire international community. I would have loved to continue this discussion with Mr. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us live from Tehran, and Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator from Los Angeles. But that's all the time that we have, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Spotlight. بسم الله
الرحمن الرحيم. Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints. كتاب الله
كتاب الله ما رو هدایت میکنه.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و آنگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
ولا تتفرقوا فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
كتاب الله.
In the limelight.
Peter Navarro, who served as White House trade advisor to former President Donald Trump, has turned himself into a federal prison in Miami, Florida. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected Navarro's last-ditch request to avoid prison. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Peter Navarro, who served as White House trade advisor to former President Donald Trump, turned himself in to a federal prison in Miami, Florida on Tuesday, 19th of March, to begin serving a four-month sentence for defying a congressional subpoena. His surrender came just one day after Chief Justice John Roberts rejected his 11th-hour bid to remain free while he appeals his conviction for contempt of Congress. Peter Navarro was assigned to an 80-person dormitory reserved for older inmates in the Miami facility, according to a source familiar with the matter, where he's expected to have some access to email and phone. At a press conference at a strip mall across the street from the prison before turning himself in, Peter Navarro claimed his case represents an unprecedented assault on the separation of powers and executive privilege. When I walk in that prison today, the justice system, such as it is, will have done a crippling blow to the constitutional separation of powers and executive privilege, he told a group of reporters. Navarro pledged to appeal his conviction to the U.S. Supreme Court and claimed his conviction stemmed from the actions of lawmakers, prosecutors and judges who are Trump haters. There is no evidence that his prosecution was politically motivated. This is the partisan weaponization of our judicial system, Navarro said, taking issue with a ruling that barred him from presenting certain defenses to the jury that is now one of the subjects of his appeal. He's the first former White House official to go to prison after being convicted of contempt of Congress. Peter Navarro was charged and found guilty after he refused to comply with a subpoena from the House Select Committee that investigated the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. Congressional investigators were seeking documents and testimony from the former White House official tied to his post-2020 election conduct and efforts to delay the certification of Electoral College votes. He was sentenced to 4 months in prison in January. He appealed both his conviction and the trial judge's decision to enforce his sentence as the appeal is further litigated. Navarro has long held that he thought he was bound by executive privilege when he refused to comply with the committee's demands, but the judge overseeing his case ruled there was no evidence that the privilege was actually invoked. Peter Navarro has been ordered to turn himself into federal prison in Miami, Florida, by Tuesday, 19th of March. A 3-judge panel on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals already rejected his bid to delay the sentence, writing he was unlikely to secure a new trial or reverse his conviction. In urging the Supreme Court to grant him emergency relief and put a hold on his surrender, Peter Navarro's lawyers argued that he is neither a flight risk nor a threat to public safety, and therefore should be allowed to remain free whilst he pursues his appeal. Dr. Navarro is the only former senior presidential advisor to be prosecuted for contempt of Congress following an assertion of executive privilege by the president that advisor served, his attorneys wrote in their request to the court. They told the justices that Navarro's prosecution for contempt of Congress violated the separation of powers doctrine, so his conviction must be reversed and the indictment against him dismissed. His legal team also argued that the questions Navarro plans to raise on appeal, which involve the assertion of executive privilege, are ones that have not been answered before and therefore warrant his release for now. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered the same story and tells us more. Peter Navarro saw his last-ditch plea to stave off prison denied by the Supreme Court on Monday, 18th of March, meaning the former aide for Donald Trump must surrender to a federal prison in Miami, Florida on Tuesday afternoon, 19th of March, to serve a 4-month sentence for ignoring a subpoena from Congress. Peter Navarro filed an emergency stay appeal on Friday, 15th of March, asking the High Court to allow him to remain out of jail as he attempts to have his contempt of Congress conviction reversed on appeal. That motion was denied on Monday afternoon, less than 24 hours before the 2 p.m. deadline he was issued. If Peter Navarro serves his full 4-month sentence as expected, he'll turn 75 the same week that he's set to be released. In denying the request, Chief Justice John Roberts said he saw no reason to disagree with an appeals court's decision that told Peter Navarro he must report to prison while his appeals process plays out. Chief Justice John Roberts noted that Monday's decision is distinct from his opinion on the actual appeal, which the Supreme Court has not been asked to rule on. Navarro was convicted in September after he argued unsuccessfully that Donald Trump gave him presidential immunity that would allow him to refuse to testify or provide documents to the House committee investigating the attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. Peter Navarro is the second Trump advisor to be convicted for defying the January 6th committee, but he'll be the first to spend time behind bars. Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's former chief strategist, lost his contempt of Congress trial in 2022, but was allowed to remain out of jail as his appeals process plays out.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hamas welcomes adoption of Gaza ceasefire resolution by the UN Security Council, stressing the need for a permanent ceasefire and withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. Iran says the UN Security Council's Gaza ceasefire resolution is a positive but inadequate step, and that the regime must